everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm happy to say we have Johann Petrowski Stern back on the show, and we'll be talking about his really interesting new book, The Anti-Imperial Choice, The Making of the Ukrainian Jew. Many of the people who listen to this show are probably familiar with a fellow named Robert Zimmerman, but you know him under a different name. He is, of course, Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan made a very unusual choice when he decided to follow, of all people, Woody Guthrie and become a folk singer. This was not the normal thing for a bright Jewish boy from the American Upper Midwest to do. Doctor, lawyer, professor was probably more common. Why did he do this? It's a very interesting question. Johannin, in this book, takes up a similar sort of query as it relates to Eastern Europe and particularly Ukraine. He's discovered a series of Jews in the Pale of Settlement who, instead of adopting the imperial culture, that is the majority culture, say Russian-speaking or German, adopted Ukrainian culture and took it as a cause of their own, and some of them became great Ukrainian poets. Sort of a tradition that Johannin has discovered, and one that sheds light not only on the Russian Empire and the Jewish experience, but the Ukrainian experience as well. So this is our first foray into Ukrainian history, and I hope that it won't be our last. I should also say that this is our 100th show, and I'd like to thank all of you for listening. I think it's been successful. I've heard from a lot of you, and I've tried to take your comments about the show under advisement and even implement some of them. And please keep those comments coming. I'd also like to thank a bunch of you for becoming fans of the show on Facebook. That helps very much because I need a measure of some sort to show my bosses here at the University of Iowa that people are listening to the show. It also tracks statistics about who listens, and I know that there are literally tens of thousands of people now, I think, who listen to the show all over the world, so thank you all for tuning in, if tuning in is what you do on the internet. So, without further ado, let me present the interview with Johann Petrowski Stern. Hi, Johann.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
It's wonderful. It's clear, sunny, and very chilly.
Windy city, as you know. Yes, the Windy City is right. No, here in Iowa, it's about the same thing, but it's very sunny and very nice. I should tell our listeners that we have Johann Petrowski Stern on the show today, and I'm very happy about that. We'll be talking about his new book, The Anti-Imperial Choice, The Making of the Ukrainian Jew. As I told Johann in the pre-interview, this is my 100th show, and I'm very pleased about that. And I wanted to have a special guest on, somebody who I knew would do a great job, and so I picked Johann. And Johann, I'm very, very pleased that you're on the show. Maybe you could begin the show by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write the book.
First, Marshall, let me congratulate you on your 100th show.
I'm
a fan of yours, and I listen to many interviews, not to all of them, I'm guilty, I know, but at least to some of the best ones, and out of this 100, I believe I've heard about 60, and they are,
that's amazing.
They are really very helpful, and they open my eyes to the questions I've never asked and to the themes I've never thought about. So I thank you for that, and I think that you are doing really a great job, and thank you for picking me up. I'm privileged and honored to be with you on your 100th show.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Now, as far as my life story is concerned, you know, when people write books, when he or she writes a new book, and they are asked, how did you come to write this book? People usually invent their life stories, so the life stories will match exactly the topic of the book. The problem is that if a person writes, if the same person writes another book, there will be a different life story. So let me use this trick and tell you that I believe I can invent another life story of mine that would fit well in the description of the anti-imperial choice. Now, as you know, I am born in Kyiv, in the Soviet Union, in the times immemorial, in the previous millennium, in the previous century, and I cannot say that I was either a Ukrainian or a Jew. It would be wrong to call me a Ukrainian Jew. Why so? Because I was born into a very much assimilated Russian-speaking family, with some very mild Jewish concerns, and certainly with no interests in things Jewish. I knew that, you know, I go to a school in Ukraine. I hear people around sometimes speaking the Ukrainian language, but it never occurred that I would discover the Ukrainian culture. It came very late to me in my life that I realized that Ukrainian culture is important, it's vibrant, it's interesting, and it is suffering from an enforced state-orchestrated Russification. Mm-hmm. And this discovery is exactly what opened my eyes toward Ukrainian culture and made me think big about where was I at that particular time.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get from there, you sort of discovered there is a Ukrainian culture, to writing a book about people who were born into the Jewish faith and then came to adopt Ukraine as their own, I guess the right way to put it is cause.
Let me tell you this. I believe we know from history that Jews who live in Europe at the end of the 19th, early 20th century usually integrate the majority, the upper class, the imperial culture,
mm-hmm.
Be it French, German, Russian. Kafka lives in Prague and dreams of his readers in Berlin and writes in the German language. Vasily Grossman is born in Berdichev, but he dreams of his Russian readers and becomes the Russian language writer.
Mm-hmm.
You do not have that many Jews who live together with Kafka, next to Kafka, in Prague and integrate, let's say, Czech culture.
Mm-hmm.
Or Jews who are there in Ukraine and who integrate the Ukrainian culture. Why
mm-hmm.
so? Because at the end of the 19th, early 20th century, the stateless cultures are considered backward, peasant-based, third rank, colonial, not interesting, and quite usually anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with that?
Mm-hmm.
Why would you want to integrate this kind of culture?
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly the question, one of the questions that I'm asking in the book. And then there is a story to how I came to write this book. One of my colleagues asked me to write an essay on a Jewish writer, poet, who writes in the Ukrainian language today. Mm-hmm. And I wrote an article about Moisei Fishbein, to whom I devoted the last chapter in my book, mm-hmm. who is an extraordinary Ukrainian poet. He lives today in Kyiv. I wrote an essay about him and realized that I am dealing with somebody who represents the pinnacle of an iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
I'm dealing with a person who certainly represents some sort of a tradition or some sort of a trend within the Ukrainian culture that we know nothing about.
Mm-hmm.
How come that this person, Moisei Fishbein, who is born in Chernivtsi, to a Yiddish and Russian-speaking family, becomes one of the major Ukrainian poets of the late 20th, early 21st century? And once I asked myself this question, I decided to look back and I try to find out whether there are other people who did the same.
Mm-hmm.
And I discovered not one, not two, not three, but many of the intellectuals, literati, writers, poets, literary critics, musicians, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth, who decided to integrate the Ukrainian culture. Mm-hmm.
And this is why the book is called The Anti-Imperial Choice, because they don't integrate into the Russian culture, or in the case of Kafka, the German culture. They integrate into a minority culture, and what is more, a minority culture that was oppressed at the end of the 19th century, and actually has been oppressed since the liberation of Ukraine in 91. So why don't we begin actually talking about one of these very interesting characters, the very first one you talk about, a certain Kerner who becomes Kernerenko. Go ahead.
Right. Right. The case of Grigory Kerner is a very interesting case. When I came across this case, I realized I'm dealing with the beginning of the tradition that I'm trying to reconstruct or discover or invent. Choose any of these verbs. Why is it so important to talk about him? He is not a writer, poet in the Ukrainian language of primary importance. He is not even the second rank writer, poet. But he is a very interesting case. He is born in Gulaipole to a very affluent Jewish family, really the upper class bourgeoisie. He goes to study agriculture and engineering in Munich. And when he comes back, he says, well, I don't want to be a bourgeois Grigory Kerner. I would like to be a Ukrainian poet, Grisko Kernerenko. And, you know, this is extraordinary. Why would you like to do, why would you want to do that? Now, not only he does that, we need to understand the context in which he is emerging as Grisko Kernerenko. And the context is certainly not favorable to anything Ukrainian.
Not at all.
At that particular time, leading Ukrainian philanthropist who sponsors the revival of Ukrainian culture in the early years of the 20th century, Yevhen Chikalenko, says that there were 7 Ukrainian-speaking families in Kyiv, in what today is the capital of Ukraine. And we are talking about Kernerenko discovering himself as Hritsko Kernerenko, 30 years before that time, mm-hmm. So in the 1870s, 1880s, mm-hmm. At that particular time, the Ukrainian language, as we know, is banished from all spheres of public life after the Ernst decree and Valuyev decree.
Mm-hmm.
The Ukrainian teachers cannot teach in the Ukrainian language at the elementary schools. Ukrainian Orthodox Christians cannot hear the sermons by the priests in the Ukrainian language, mm-hmm. because language is forbidden to be used even in the sermons, let alone in the publications, journals, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
It is in this context that Kernerenko is saying, I would like to become the Ukrainian poet.
Mm-hmm.
He starts writing Ukrainian poetry and Ukrainian prose narrative. The Ukrainian writers and poets discover him. He writes a letter presenting himself to Ivan Franko, who is seen today as one of the founders of modern Ukrainian literature. Franko says, wow, we have here a person who wants to be one of us. Franko at that time is not in the Ukraine proper. He is in the Ukrainian territory, which is under Austro-Hungarian Empire at the time, in Galicia, where he creates a number of venues for the development of Ukrainian culture, including his major journal, in which he starts publishing the poetry, prose narrative, and the translations of Hritsko Kernerenko.
Mm-hmm.
So now, Kernerenko is not only the person who wants to create his Ukrainian self, he is also very critical about what Ukraine is at that particular time. He understands that he is dealing with a culture that has anti-Jewish bias. He is dealing with people who are not really eager to embrace him, but he wants to be a Ukrainian poet. What do you do with that? And he writes a very moving poetry in which he uses the patterns, the style, the imagery, and metaphors of Heinrich Heine, another poet of dual identity, German-Jewish in this case, in order to convey his feelings and his understanding of his own Kernerenko's encounter with the contemporary Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And he writes, «Прощай, Україна моя, тебе я кинуть мушу, хоча до тебе я віддав життя і волю і душу, але я пасинок тобі, на жаль, це добре знаю, і проміж других дітей твоїх я не живу, страждаю». Не сила знести вже мені глумлінь тих понад міру за те, що я і твої сини не одну маємо віру. Тебе ж, Україна моя, я буду вік кохати, бо ти хоч мачуха мені, а все ж ти мені мати. Let me briefly translate what he is saying here. Fare thee well, my Ukraine. I need to leave you. Thou for you I have sacrificed my life and freedom and soul. But I'm your stepson, and I know this only too well. Among you other children, I live not, but I suffer. I cannot any more tolerate the mockery of the fact that your sons and I are of different faiths. Yet you, my Ukraine, I will love forever. Albeit you treat me as a stepson, still you are my mom. Mm-hmm. This is a very moving poetry, and it is wonderfully articulated in Ukrainian. Mm-hmm. What amazes me in this poem is that it is certainly about his desire to be part of the Ukrainian milieu, the Ukrainian culture, mm-hmm. his desire to present himself as a Ukrainian poet, his desire to feel that Ukraine is his mom. Mm-hmm. This is a very important metaphor that comes from the times of Shevchenko to nowadays Ukrainian poetry, mm-hmm. the image of Ukraine as the mother. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he understands there are problems with his desire to integrate this culture because, he belongs to a different faith. He's not becoming a Russian Orthodox in order to become the Ukrainian. He still wants to be accepted as a Jew, and that creates a major problem. And he discusses this grappling with his dual Ukrainian-Jewish identity in this poem. Mm-hmm. That makes him, I believe, very unique among those who are seeking the integration into a different culture, in this case into a colonial, stateless, Ukrainian, anti-Semitic culture, or at least as a culture that is perceived as this type of culture by his contemporaries, certainly by his Jewish contemporaries. Mm-hmm.
But he still has a foot in both worlds, as you say. He's involved in the Ukrainian discovery of Shalom Aleichem, isn't he?
Right. That's another interesting aspect of what he does. We might think that my characters, the people who I describe in the book, are integrating Ukrainian culture and dissolving themselves in the Ukrainian culture. This is not happening. Kernerenko, as well as Raisa Troyanker, Leonid Prvomaisky, Moisey Fishbein, and others, they convey their Jewish concerns in the Ukrainian language, and they infuse the Ukrainian poetry and prose narrative with the Jewish imagery, Jewish metaphors, and very important Jewish cultural references. In this particular case, in case of Hrysko Kernerenko, at a certain point, he becomes a medium through which Ivan Franko discovers the Yiddish the Yiddish literature. Franco asks Kernerenko in one of his letters, who is this Shalom Aleichem? And, right, which is a legitimate question for a Ukrainian-speaking person in 1899. Mm-hmm. Right, and Kernerenko explains, this is the best-known writer in the jargon, as Yiddish is called at that particular time. Franco says, well, if this is such an important writer, let's have him translate it. So Kernerenko translates pieces from Shalom Aleichem into Ukrainian, which are then published in Franco's journal. He does the same with the Russian language poet Semyon Frug, who is at the time perhaps one of the most well-known Russian Jewish poets. Mm-hmm. He translates, Krenerka translates Frug into the Ukrainian language, and his translations are published again in the Ukrainian journals. So he is a bridge between cultures, and he also makes Russian, Jewish, and Yiddish culture visible for the Ukrainian readers. Moreover, he is taking pieces of Jewish religious tradition and infusing his Ukrainian poetry with the elements of Jewish culture. He writes Ukrainian poetry about Jewish messianism. He writes Ukrainian poetry about the events in Jewish social life. He has a major poem about the cancellation of the Jewish privilege to sell and produce alcohol. He says how important it is for the Jews not to do that anymore. Nobody will call Jews the people who make Russian or Ukrainian peasant drunk. Mm-hmm. So he is really at the forefront of the of pondering the experience of Jews in East Europe and the encounter with the Slavic cultures,
and all in the Ukrainian language. That's pretty incredible. How is Kinyanenko remembered today? Is he remembered by the Ukrainian literati?
Absolutely. You know, I was fascinated to discover that there are scholars of local histories in central Ukraine that rediscovered Kernerenko, wrote articles about him. You would find a major newspaper in Zaporozhye or in Dnipropetrovsk or in Poltava that have articles about Kernerenko and that celebrate his firm stance on the issues of Ukrainian revivalism. Hmm. These people are saying, look, we live still in this milieu which is Russified, which votes for Yanukovych, which looks at the Kremlin as the redeemer, and so on and so forth. But here you have a Jew who, at the end of the 19th century, says Ukrainian culture is a very important self-contained phenomenon, mm-hmm. and we should help it to be more visible. We should develop it. We should integrate this culture, and we should certainly invest our heart and nerve and sinew into it.
Mm. That's fascinating. Let's actually move on to the next author you deal with, a certain Ivan Hulik. He's quite a different character, but every bit is unique.
Right. Kulik is the unique character among the unique characters. unlike Kernerenko, who is certainly a person who supports and who promotes Ukrainian revivalism, Kulik supports and promotes what people called in the mid-1920s the national communism. And by the national communism in Kulik case, I mean the encounter of two utopias. One, Ukrainian-centered utopia of the Slavic cultures, and another is the international proletarian revolution of Bukharin's type. Let me explain to you very briefly how Kulik came to the discovery of this kind of national communism, because you know his itinerary is a very interesting.
Yeah, he makes his way around.
right. He traveled a lot before he found out how to put these things together. He's born to a Yiddish and Russian-speaking family in Shpola, which is in the Ukraine. Then, when he is 2 or 3 years old, his family moves to Umань, which, as we know, is a major attraction for Hasidim, for the pious Jews from all over the world. In Umань, his father works as a melamed in Talmud Torah, which is a teacher in an elementary Jewish school. Kulik is not interested in anything Jewish. He is interested in his encounters with Ukrainian village dwellers who come to the local parks to play Cossacks, bandits, robbers, smugglers, and he plays with them. Now, where do they play? They play on the territory of the famous Sofievka Park. Sofievka Park is an English-style park with cataracts, grottos, woods, statues of Greek gods and goddesses, rotundas, and so on and so forth. This is the park established by the Count Potocki in the early years of the 19th century. It's a beautiful park. So Kulik is playing the Cossacks with his Ukrainian fellows out there, and from them he picks his Ukrainian language. And he writes a moving poetry later in his life about his encounter with the rural-based Ukraine in this Sofievka Park. Then he discovers that his brother is arrested. His brother becomes a Marxist. He is involved with revolutionary circles in Uman. He is taken to prison, and somebody needs to take letters from the prison to the fellows of his brother who are in the underground. And Kulik, who is 7 or 8 years old, does exactly this. He becomes a mailman. A revolutionary mailman. Right. So this is his first encounter with...
That's quite an image. Revolutionary mailman. That is...
Revolutionary mailman. Yeah. Exactly. Now, at the same time, he discovers that he is very much interested in the Ukrainian culture. Now, perhaps you know about this famous expedition by Shlomo Anskey to the Pale Settlement. Shlomo Anskey is a Yiddish writer and Russian writer, and he is an ethnographer, and he organizes an expedition to the Pale Settlement that collects the artifacts of Jewish life, Jewish pictures, Jewish stories, Jewish folklore, and so on and so forth. This expedition took place between 1911 and 1913, and I'm telling you this because it is an important backdrop to my story. Kulik most likely knows about this expedition, or he heard that there are people who are interested in the material culture of the Jewish world. Now, he lives in the center of the Jewish world, but he's not interested in things Jewish. He goes to the nearby villages around Uman, and he puts on paper kolyatki, shidrivki, and other genres of the Ukrainian folklore. He is interested in the design of Ukrainian pisanki, which is this Easter eggs that are painted very beautifully before Easter. I'm sure you've
seen
them.
Oh, yes. I've seen them. Yes, absolutely.
Right. So he's copying the designs of this pisanki. And later, when he is about 13 years old, he is... he is co-opted by the local Uman branch of the Society for the Preservation of Monuments, and he makes a presentation there about the Ukrainian folklore, about the material culture of the nearby villages, emphasizing the importance of the study of Ukrainian folklore. So it is fascinating that when Jews of his... type of origin are interested in the material culture of the shtetl, he is interested in the material culture of the Ukrainian village. Now, he certainly cannot make both ends meet in Uman. He goes to study painting in Odessa. He cannot pay for his his studies. He has no money. He decides to leave the old world for good, and he moves to the United States. In the United States, he is cheated by his Jewish relatives, he runs away, and he becomes a miner in Pennsylvania. Uh-huh. Now, when he is in Pennsylvania, he is looking for a milieu to be integrated by, and he discovers Nikolai Bukharin, who is at the time editing the Novy Mir, the New World Journal, newspaper, not a journal.
Yeah.
Nikolai Bukharin, who is at that time editing the Novy Mir newspaper, which is a Russian socialist Marxist newspaper in New York. Kulik starts writing journalistic articles for this newspaper, and his encounter with Bukharin galvanizes him because he realizes there is such a thing as the international proletarian revolution that will come to redeem the world from oppression, that which will come to redeem the oppressed proletarians all over the world. He is so much galvanized by Bukharin that when they both learned about the February Revolution in Russia, they leave New York and they go through the United States, through Yokohama, to Vladivostok, from Vladivostok to Moscow, to be the participants of this new Russian Revolution. Bukharin remains in Moscow. Kulik goes to Ukraine, and in Ukraine, he is appointed, or I would say he is elected by the Red Cossacks to be the first commissar of the Red Cossack unit in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is another episode in his life story, his participation in the Civil War, his arrest, his imprisonment. He spends about a year in Polish prison. He is redeemed by the Bolsheviks from the prison. But when he's in prison, he writes his first book. And his first book ever written is the book of the Ukrainian verse, mm-hmm. which brings together the Ukrainian folklore. It's called Мої Коломейки. Коломейка is a typical genre of Ukrainian Christmas folklore. So it is this kind of the genre imbued with the revolutionary imagery of Ukrainian Cossacks, Ukrainian proletarians fighting for the liberation of the people of the world. So it brings together the international and the Ukrainian folklore
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In a very cohesive, coherent, and compelling way. It is really an interesting Ukrainian poetry, quite experimental and quite compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Then Kulik finds himself again overseas. He is sent as the consul of the Ukrainian trade mission to Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you are a Soviet bureaucrat in the West, so far in the West, in Canada, what do you do? Well, you can do many things, right? You can be a spy. You can be. You can enjoy life. You can talk to the Canadians about the importance of the Ukrainian revivalism and Ukrainian communism. Kulik does not do that. Kulik is much more interested in educating the Ukrainian diaspora. He goes to Halifax. He goes to Ottawa. He goes to Winnipeg. He goes to Alberta. He goes to all different places to give lectures about Ukraine. He establishes links with the local Ukrainian choir. He helps put on stage Ukrainian plays. He writes about Ukraine to local socialist Ukrainian newspapers, most importantly to the newspaper Robotnichi Vesti, Ukrainski Robotnichi Vesti, Ukrainian Labor News. 2 weeks ago, I was in Winnipeg, and I gave a lecture about Kulik to about 45, 50 unrepentant Marxists who came to get...
I wondered where they all had gone. I guess
it's a very interesting world. And I gave this lecture in the Ukrainian labor temple,
yeah.
built in 1921, exactly in the temple where Kulik gave his lecture in 1925.
That's amazing.
Okay? Now, why Kulik is doing that? Because he's absolutely confident that if there is any kind of liberation that comes to the world, it will come from Ukraine and through Ukraine. If there is any kind of the revolution in the world, it can be only the international revolution centered in Ukraine. Let me give you some sense of what he's writing after he spans almost 2 years in Canada. Hey, my fertile Alberta, Mahno will come for you. Whatever you do, but you will rise renewed. Hi, my British Columbia, your forests and marshes will soon learn the jokes of the Volinia guerrilla. Hi, my pedantic Halifax, the port of the future, glory and progress. You think it is simple? Wouldn't you like as it was in Odessa? And so on and so forth. And he finishes his long poem. And even you, my Yukon, will never hide under the snows, for in the nearest days you will redden as a new Donbass. And yours, Ottawa, the capital, a proud House of Commons, will be ardently ruled by the all-Canadian Soviet Commissariat.
People all over Canada are loving you right now. I'm telling you what.
Right. Go ahead. In Winnipeg, I was driving through the narrow streets that have wooden houses built in the 1910s and 1920s by the Ukrainian emigres, and some of those houses would have posters. Put profit aside. Vote for communists.
Wow. Yeah.
And you're driving there and you're thinking, well, am I in, yeah. Is this January 2010?
Yeah.
Right. But this is what Kulik is about. And he is he's a true believer. He is not one of these, Soviet bureaucrats who are using the Marxist or national revivalist ideology to move along and to have a great career. No, he's really a believer, and he is writing about his things in prose poetry. He has about 7 books of poetry, about 4 books of prose narrative, enormous amount of excellent journalistic articles. And what is very important for him in Canada at that particular time, he discovers his double. He discovers in Canada a person with who he wants to identify himself. And this discovery comes as a revelation. Who is this person? Perhaps you know that about the 1860s in Canada, there were 2 rebellions of the Métis Indians who were trying to fight against the British imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these rebellions were led by a person whose name was Louis Riel, who could have become a priest or a lawyer, and who decided, who decided that he would join the rebellious movement of the local Indians in Manitoba. And he did exactly that. Moreover, he was elected by the Indians as the representative and as the leader of the movement. Hmm. So you have a person who comes from the majority culture and says, well, I would like to do things for the Indians. This is my anti-imperial choice.
Mm-hmm.
He is later arrested, and he is found guilty of state treason, and he's hanged. So only later, at the beginning of the 20th century, Canadians made him into a national hero. What is important for Kulik, and I believe he knows about that, Louis Riel does not call himself Louis Riel. He says, I would be Louis David Riel. Why does he need the name David? Because he says, I will be for these Indians what King David had been for the Jews in the land of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
I will help them create their own state. I will help
them. Build them a kingdom.
Yes, exactly. So Louis Riel is this kind of character that Ivan Kulik recognizes as his double. And Kulik writes extensively about Riel, conveying the idea of the anti-imperial rebellion, the anti-imperial choice, the importance of helping the oppressed, the persecuted, the marginalized cultures to find their own self and to struggle for their own political, cultural, social independence.
Mm-hmm. So Kulik, when he comes back from Canada, he's trade representative for a while. He comes back, and since he is a national communist, he does well when national communism is à la mode. But by the 1930s, it's not à la mode anymore, and he runs afoul of the Stalinist by this time apparatus. Why don't you tell that story?
Kulik is doing very well in the 1920s, as you mentioned, Marshall, and in the early 1930s, to the extent that when in the Soviet Union they create this umbrella organizations for writers and poets, which would be called later the Union of the Soviet Socialist Writers, Kulik, together with Ivan Mikitenko, becomes the head of the Ukrainian Union of Writers. Just think about it. The person who is born as Israel Yudovich Kulik, who becomes Ivan Kulik, now is the head of the Ukrainian Union of Writers. That's
something.
It is, you know, it is the story that we can spend some time at another occasion. But I believe it's not a trivial case. Kulik writes his major poem, which is called Chorna Epopeya, the Black Epic Poetry, which he infuses with Afro-American tunes, genre, melodies. He is perhaps the first Ukrainian writer to use the rhythms and metrical system of the Afro-American poetry, and also of the poetry of such writers as Edgar Lee Masters and certainly Walt Whitman. We need also to think about Kulik's attempts to make the world literature visible in Ukrainian. He puts together what became the first anthology of the American poetry in the Ukrainian language. It's a 300, maybe 400 page long anthology of the American poetry from Walt Whitman to the 1920s, which Kulik put together and translated into the Ukrainian language. It was published in 1927 in Ukraine. Nothing like that has been published in Ukraine since then, by the way. The 1930s a very difficult time for him. He is trying to find himself in the situation where people who he was very close with, such as Skripnik, such as Khvedevy, had committed suicide. The moment when they realized that the encounter of national revivalism with leftist communism is no more possible. Kulik tries to adapt new values and adopt himself to these new values. He's not very successful. He's extremely influential in the 1930s. He is the head of Partii Vidalov, the party publishing house, the most important publishing house in Ukraine at the time. He is the head of the Union of Writers. He is widely published. But the quality of his poetry in the mid-1930s cannot be compared to what he does in the 1920s. The NKVD comes for him in 1937. He is arrested, accused of spying against the Soviet Ukraine. The accusation says that he wanted to bring such emigre figures as Vinnichenko to Ukraine in order to, so to say, turn back the course of history and prevent Ukraine from becoming socialist. Mm-hmm. He's shot immediately thereafter, and his wife is also arrested and shot exactly at that time. Mm-hmm. For 20 years, his name is erased from Ukrainian literature, and only in the late 1960s, early 1970s, he slowly but steadily comes back. Mm-hmm. Still, his three-volume collected writings that were put together in the early 1970s are sitting in the archive in Ukraine collecting dust, and he still awaits for another discovery.
Mm-hmm, I see. Yohanan, tell me about Raisa Trayankar.
Raisa Trayankar is another person who was rediscovered recently by postmodern and feministic-minded scholars, literary critics, reading public in Ukraine. She wrote just two books of Ukrainian verse in the 1920s, but among the unusual men that I'm discussing in the book, she is a very, very unusual woman. Also born in Uman to a Russian and Yiddish-speaking family, also grew up as a person who rejected her Judaic beliefs and the shtetl-esque environment, fell in love with a number of Ukrainian poets and decided that she will emancipate her colonized Jewish self through her erotic encounters with Ukrainian literati. It's a very interesting way of emancipating
oneself.
Right,
so by erotic encounters, you mean that, to put it in plain style English, she was having sex with these people.
Yes.
Yes, okay, yeah, just, you know, I'm from the Midwest, and we need things put very directly. Yeah.
Right. Let me tell you that to say that she had sex with Ukrainian writers is a statement that needs to be explained.
Yes, please explain.
She always sought her sexual partners among precisely the Ukrainian writers and poets, and she was very well known for doing that. To the extent that in the unpublished memoirs by a major Ukrainian writer of that time, Yuri Smolich, she is mentioned as having tempted dozens of great Ukrainian writers. So probably anybody who was something on the Ukrainian literary horizon was tempted by Raisa Troyanka.
So was she a what we call a groupie? You know what a groupie is?
No. She had short-term erotic encounters with many different people, not at the same time, she was really very much interested in tempting Ukrainian writers.
Yeah, I didn't mean to. I'm sorry to interrupt, but for those listening closely, I didn't mean to insult Raisa Troyanker or women in general by saying that she might be a groupie. So no emails, please. I'm sorry. I didn't mean anything by that. Go ahead, Johanan.
Let me explain the other side of this encounter. She grew up in a Jewish environment. Her father was a scholar of Talmud in Uman, very well known in the community. And the restrictions of traditional Judaism was something that Raisa Troyanker could not stand. And she rebelled. Her rebellion could have been expressed in different ways. But her rebellion manifested itself precisely in this, in the breaking of the erotic taboos, sexual taboos. She started as a 14-year-old lover of a person who brought a vagabond circus to Uman.
Hmm.
He was a tamer of tigers, and he was her first erotic partner. And Raisa ran away from her parents to this tamer of tigers. And she spent time working with tigers in the circus. So she was really a person of enormous courage.
I should say.
We know that she was featured on the posters that were issued by this vagabond circus.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about her writing.
Right. When she moved from Uman to Kharkiv, she enrolled in a local teacher's training institute and started to get published. She was very close with a number of avant-garde groups. There was such a group in Kharkiv, a Ukrainian avant-garde group called Avant-Garde. And her books were shaped as avant-garde Ukrainian poetry featuring three major themes. one theme makes you a very unusual character in the Ukrainian literary milieu at the time. She depicted the shtetl.
Mm-hmm.
The shtetl that she abandoned, that she had abandoned, the shtetl which was about traditional Jewish life, her imposing parents, Judaic tradition, yarmulkes, the Talmud, the Torah learning, and kosher stuff that they had at home all the time. Instead of saying, you know, I'm a member of the Young Communist League and I deny this past, she says, despite the fact that I'm the member of the Young Communist League, I love this past. And this is a very unusual something for a 20-year-old avant-garde poet. She really infused her poetry, her Ukrainian lyric poetry, with the images of her parents, with the images of the decaying, moribund, godforsaken shtetl, and she loves it. She loves this milieu. She shows that it is a very warm household where people treat you nicely, where you still feel empathy toward you, whoever you are. So she tells the story of her visits to her family, where she has an ongoing debate with her father about the future of the Jews, about the future of the Ukrainians. And her father says, you know, Zion, Palestine, religious values. And she says, urban milieu, the construction of communism, Ukraine. And this debate is very interestingly interwoven into a poetic dialogue, which you see in her poetry. So the shtetl is one of her themes. Another theme is quite obvious, since she is part of the futuristic circle. She describes the growing society in this new industrial cities in eastern Ukraine. First and foremost, Kharkiv. Kharkiv really was a kind of a New York of the 1920s with skyscrapers with new buildings of concrete and glass, the avant-garde kind of architecture was very visible in Kharkiv at that time. So she describes the growth of Ukrainian industrial cities. The third theme is really groundbreaking. I believe Troyanka is the first to introduce a very warm eroticism into the Ukrainian poetry.
Hmm.
So she describes her encounters, her sex with Ukrainian poets in her poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, but it's also very interesting that for her to become emancipated, to feel herself freed, to feel herself part of the greater humanity, is, I would say, I'm looking for a word, is something that requires this encounter with a Ukrainian poet.
Mm-hmm.
And by encounter, I mean having sex.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Ukrainian poet, you have Raisa Troyanka, and she emancipates her body through this encounter,
mm-hmm.
and she also emancipates her poetic ego. So she can become a poet only through having sex with a Ukrainian poet. And her having sex with a Ukrainian poet makes her into a free human being, able to do whatever she wants, able to express herself in wonderful Ukrainian lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how unusual it is? It is very unusual for the late 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
She writes this she publishes these two volumes of Ukrainian books. Then she tempted another poet who happened to be Leningrad-based and not Kyiv or Kharkiv-based, and she travels with him to Leningrad, where she spends 4 or 5 years. Then he abuses her physically. There was home violence. She runs away from him. She does not want any kind of violence applied to her. So she runs away from him, and he finds herself in Murmansk.
Mm-hmm.
And she spends the last 10 years of her life, she died in 1945, in Murmansk as a war journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Murmansk, there is another part of her story, which is not a Ukrainian part of her story, because she becomes a Russian language journalist, and she publishes a book of Russian verse, which is, you know, 5 levels lower than her Ukrainian verse.
Mm.
But people who knew her in Murmansk were fascinated by her courage. She would go to the front lines of the North Polar Division of the Soviet troops, and she would recite Alexander Blok, Nikolai Gumilev, Anna Akhmatova, Maxim Rilsky, and other Russian and Ukrainian poets to the soldiers sitting in the trenches, in the front line,
mm-hmm.
under the German fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's brave.
And people found it fascinating. We have memoirs of Raisa Troyanka behaving courageously at that particular time, 1940s.
And how is she remembered today, very briefly?
a number of female Ukrainian literary critics uncovered her, published a number of her poems, realized they are dealing with an unusual case,
mm-hmm.
and there were afterward a number of scholars who became interested in her, including, you know, very solid literary scholars in the Ukrainian Academy of Sciences who published article about her. And just to tell you, last year was 100th anniversary of her birthday.
Mm-hmm.
In Poltava, the local literary historian published a book of Troyanka's poetry and Russian and Ukrainian poetry with his 60-page-long preface.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot get the book anywhere in Ukraine because it was sold like in 2 weeks.
I see. Okay, so let's move on very quickly to Leonid Pervomaisky, that would be, for those of you who don't know Russian or Ukrainian, I suppose, that's Leonid the 1st of May, which probably wasn't his given name.
Right. He was born Ilya Shlomovich Hurevich. Again, we are dealing with a case where a person is born to a Russian and Yiddish-speaking family, but decided to integrate the Ukrainian culture in the Ukraine and become a Ukrainian poet and writer. Of the 5 writers and poets that I'm discussing in the book, Leonid Pervomaisky really made it to the pantheon of the 20th century Ukrainian literati. He is very much revered. There are streets named after his name. There are, you know, steamships named after him. There are schools and libraries named after him. So he's very well known. Entire 7-volume collection of writings was published 3 or 4 times over the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not an unknown figure. But the unusual thing about Leonid Pervomaisky is that in the late 1920s, early 1930s, when he started his career, he wanted to become a Ukrainian Isaac Babel.
Mm-hmm.
And he did not start as a poet. He wrote 2 or 3 collections of prose narrative. At least one of them is a novel, another is a collection of stories. And they are about a Ukrainian-Jewish encounter. They're about Ukrainians and Jews in the shtetls, in the small towns of Ukraine, before the Socialist Revolution of 1917 and after that. He describes the shtetl. He describes the regeneration of Jews who were living in this moribund, godforsaken towns, and now in the 1920s are emerging as robust Ukrainian peasants of Jewish origin.
Mm-hmm.
He discusses the transformation of the East European Jews, looking at them against the backdrop of Ukrainization, and he makes Jews into Ukrainians in
mm-hmm.
his prose narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So what is important in the 1930s, he was still publishing his plays, very, very popular, about Jews becoming agricultural dwellers in Ukraine, about the establishment of agricultural colonies in the southern Ukraine, about this Jewish-Ukrainian rapprochement. But later he had to abandon this theme once and for all. And when in the 1960s he wanted to republish some of his stories that had appeared in the 1920s, he literally transformed them into something different, erasing all the significant references to Jewish themes.
Why did he do that?
Because he wanted to save his prose narrative for republication. Mm-hmm. He wanted these things to be republished. But the censorship did not allow him to have this Ukrainian Jewish narratives.
Mm-hmm.
So he really rewrote many of his previous stuff to save it for the publication.
Mm-hmm.
What I did in the book, I recovered his original publications of 1926, 1929, 1932, and through them, I reconstructed what Prvomaisky was at that particular time,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and not how he wanted to present himself and mm-hmm. present his past in the 1960s.
So the Prvomaisky that we know today, or that most Russians would know, it is the sanitized or communized or Stalinized.
Very much.
Yes, Prvomaisky. So, are his original publications, the original versions, going to be published? Are you publishing them? Or should we tattoo them on my back? Or how do we get them out?
certainly, there are things that should be republished. But you know, the grandson of Prvomaisky, who lives now somewhere near Vienna. Is in control of the entire archive of Prvomaisky, and he publishes the original stuff of Prvomaisky every 2-3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So there is somebody who is taking care of the reintroducing Prvomaisky to us.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, in 2004, he published a very interesting book of satires, Prvomaisky satires, against Ukrainian anti-Semites, against the official communist writers and poets, and they are mind-blowing. You
mm-hmm.
you read the satire and you cannot imagine that something like that could have been written in, let's say, 1957.
Mm-hmm.
Very sharp, mm-hmm. excellent Heine-esque poetry,
mm-hmm.
with the dialogue between Prvomaisky's alter ego and his interlocutor, who seems to be one of the major anti-Semitic-minded official Ukrainian poets mm-hmm. at the time. And you have 25 pages of poetry of their dialogue,
mm-hmm.
and they debate who of them really represents Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
This, you know, staunch anti-Semite and ironclad Bolshevik, or Prvomaisky with his problematic origin and his dual identity.
Mm-hmm. I see. We are running reasonably short on time, so I want to move on very quickly to talk about a fellow who's still alive, I guess, Moisei Fishbein. Is he still alive? Is that right?
Yeah, he's still there. He traveled a lot. Moisei Fishbein is still alive. He is now in Kyiv. He was born in Chernivtsi in Bukovina, the town that remembered the Austro-Hungarian Empire as the utopian times, and that saw itself in the 1950s as the vestige of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Fishbein studied in Novosibirsk. He could not get to any higher educational establishment in Ukraine. Then he was found by high-ranking Ukrainian poets, invited to Kyiv, spent time in Kyiv, integrated himself into the milieu of Ukrainian writers and poets who called themselves the poets and writers of the 60s. So this liberal democratic milieu published his first book of poetry, fascinating book of poetry, which shows that he really started as perhaps the only one poet in Ukraine with straightforward metaphysical concerns. The person who did not discuss, you know, the construction of the new society or socialism or, you know, the exploration of cosmos, but rather who discusses life and death, black and white, the Holocaust, the victims, the victimization of culture, the language as a victim of politics and other things. He was made to emigrate from Ukraine. He spent some time in Israel, and he became he became a commentator at the Radio Liberty of Europe in Munich. And after the events of 1991, when Ukraine finally became an independent country, he moved back to Ukraine. What is interesting, when he was in the Russian army, somewhere near Vladivostok, he realized that he is banished from Ukraine, and Ukraine is his fatherland, and Ukraine is the center of his universe. That is to say, when he was in Israel, he also saw himself as banished from Ukraine. So Israel, yeah. for him, and by the way, he speaks Hebrew. He knows Yiddish. He is a person who lights candles over Hanukkah and congratulates you with Passover. So he's really vested. He has vested interest in his Judaic self. But for him to be in Germany or to be in Israel or to be in the Far East means to be in diaspora. When he goes to Ukraine, he goes back. He is one of these rare poets who is constantly pondering the role of the language, and he sees himself as the redeemer of the Ukrainian language. He turns to the Ukrainian language and says, «І темрява клубочиться зимово, ідущий ним просотує сльота, горнись до мене, мовенятко, мово, неторкана, гвалтована, свята». So he turns to the Ukrainian language and says, turn to me, my language. He uses a feminine diminutive when he turns to the Ukrainian language. You are untouched, raped, and sacred. And he sees himself as a redeemer of this language. He redeems the Ukrainian language from the imposed Russification, from the assimilation, from the loss of its genuine, what he says, genuine Ukrainian identity, and he returns this identity to the language. This messianic striving of Fishbane makes him a very interesting figure on the Ukrainian horizon. Nobody has ever dared to say, you know, I am the redeemer of the Ukrainian language. But Fishbane does exactly that.
I want to, again, we're kind of running out of time, but I want to take the last few minutes to talk about a couple of more general issues that I noticed in reading the book and listening to you. And they're all relatively contemporary and not historical or even poetic, I suppose. But one of the things that you do note in reading the book is that at least four of the people that you deal with in becoming Ukrainian literati have to give up or truncate their Jewish identities. And I'm thinking of Kirnarenko, Kulik, Trajankar, and Peter Vomaisky. They all become something that isn't Jewish. Is it possible today to be a Ukrainian nationalist or Ukrainian writer and actually be an observant Jew in the kind of way that and Americans don't have any problem with this, obviously, but I don't know, it probably happens in Western Europe as well. What is the sort of status of it's really hard to know what to say here, Jewish literati in Ukraine writing in Ukrainian?
Okay, Marshall, let me please correct you. I do think that these people who you mentioned, they had to leave their Jewish self, so to say, behind when they integrated the Ukrainian culture. However, what makes them very unusual people, and I'm emphasizing this in the book, they are creating a Ukrainian Jewish narrative, either prose narrative or poetry. They all use Jewish imagery in Ukrainian poetry. They are discussing how to reconcile these two selves. And the reconciliation or non-reconciliation becomes a drama and trauma that they have to grapple with in their literary endeavors. However, let me get back to the second half of your question. When you're saying, when you're asking whether it is possible to be an observant Jew or relatively traditional Jew and still supportive of Ukrainian nationalism, I say yes, absolutely yes. And this particular encounter of, let's say, somebody's traditional Judaic self and Ukrainian national strivings became possible, you would be surprised to hear where and how. It became possible due to the encounter of the Zionists and Ukrainian nationalists arrested for their human rights activities in the times of Brezhnev, sentenced to different terms, usually 7-8 years of the correction colony, and sent to the correction colonies where they found themselves engaged in a very intensive dialogue. I mean, particularly Ukrainians, conscious Ukrainians, national-minded Ukrainians, and Jews. And there are very important writings. There is an entire discourse created by their dialogue and shaped by their dialogue, which is about Ukrainians and Jews discovering themselves as people of different creeds, of different backgrounds, with very different vectors in life. But they are constantly learning from one another how to create their own national historical narrative, Jews from Ukrainians and Ukrainians from Jews. Because of this background, which became quite well known in the 1990s in Ukraine, it is not impossible to see Jews aware of their Jewishness and of their, you know, either Israeli or traditional Judaic values. Finding Ukrainian values and Ukrainian national strivings quite commendable.
What is this? This is a kind of a broader question. What is it? How many Jews are there in Ukraine today? I don't even know. There was a massive outflow of Jews from the from the Russian Federation. Is that true in Ukraine as well?
Well, look, it is difficult to give precise data. I would say between 350 and 450,000 Jews there are in Ukraine right now.
I see. And is this this tradition of, I guess I'd call it Jewish writing in Ukrainian, is it identified as such and taught in universities and schools? I know that in the case of someone like Piotr Romaisky or Fishbein, you know, these are important poets, but the more obscure, if I can use that word, poets, are they recognized as well?
May I be self-praising?
Yes, you may.
Okay.
I usually do that for you, but you go ahead.
Okay. Marshall, I think I am discovering this tradition, qua tradition. There were figures recognized as important Ukrainian Jewish figures. For instance, let me mention Yeremia Eisenstock, who is perhaps the most well-known scholar of Taras Shevchenko of the first half of the 20th century. There were other people recognized as important Jewish contributors to Ukrainian culture. For instance, if you go to Kyiv and you are on the subway, you will hear this famous song, "Як тебе не любити Київ мій?" How can I not love you, my Kyiv? This song was written by a Ukrainian composer, Igor Shamo, who is Jewish. So people would recognize that there are important Jews who contributed to the Ukrainian culture, but nobody was ever talking about, nobody has ever been talking about the tradition, about the discourse, about the something that we can trace down from the 1880s till the 1990s and see these people as being in contact with one another, either genetically or genealogically or through the prism of cultural genealogy. So they are aware of one another. Just to give you one one example, Kulik found Pervomaisky and gave him a push at the beginning of his literary career. Pervomaisky, when he was already a renowned poet, welcomed Fishbane and blessed him. So you do have this kind of an encounter of people of different generations who see themselves as continuing one and the same line. I don't care if we are if we have, you know, 10 people in this tradition, but they are important. Now, why I'm telling you this story, it's a preface to a very important, to a very simple point. No, this tradition, qua tradition, is not taught because I have just discovered it. My book is being translated. I'm not asking for a Pulitzer Prize, Marshall.
Yeah, so your the book's being translated?
My book is being translated into Ukrainian right now. Harvard University and Kritika Publishers will publish the book probably at the end of this year, beginning of the next year, and we'll live happily ever after. We'll see what will be the response of the Ukrainian critics.
I'm sure it'll be very positive. I can predict that. I'm happy to predict that. Now, let me. We've taken up a huge amount of your time, and I really want to thank you. It's always enjoyable to talk to you. Let me ask our traditional final question on this 100th episode of New Books in History, and that is, Johann, what are you working on now?
Marshall, I just sent the proofs to Yale University Press. Yale is publishing my new book, which is called Lenin's Jewish Question. It's about how Lenin treated the Bolsheviks of Jewish descent, and it's about Lenin's maternal great-grandfather, whose name was Moshe Blank, and who was born Jewish in the small shtetl called Starokonstantinov in the Pale of Settlement.
Wow.
Once I see this book published, I will get to my new book project, which is entitled, tentatively entitled, Shtetl as It Was, or Shtetl as It Really Was, where I'm trying to recover the material culture of the late 18th, early 19th century Jewish market town in the Pale of Settlement.
Well, that's terrific, and I look forward to talking to you about the Lenin book and the book about the shtetl. I really do, and I want to thank you very much for being on the show. As I said, I always enjoy talking to you, and I really appreciate it.
Marshall, honored and pleased.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Johann Petrovsky Stern about his new book, The Anti-Imperial Choice, The Making of the Ukrainian Jew. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.